Yes, you lovely people, if you're not already, make sure you give us a follow over on Spotify.
And he said, look, you see them? Them boys, they might have a lot of talent. They might have a lot of talent, but they haven't got what we've got in this dressing room. And as you said it, honestly, every
I'm
one of us.
I'm getting goosebumps.
I'm mad
goosebumps.
My eyes are watering. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Fozcast. Today, we have got what I honestly think will be one of the most interesting episodes. Tom, do you agree?
100%.
100%. Yeah. I am really looking forward to diving into this one. We have got Dr. Suzanne Brown, who is a... I'll let you describe yourself, Suzanne. Thank Go on. You. The floor is yours. Take it away.
Thank you. So I'm a clinical psychologist and an emotional fitness consultant, and I'm the founder of Emotionally Connected.
Beautiful. That's you said that so much better than what I'd have been able to say that. Okay, Suzanne, so the reason we've got you in today is because I've had a 20-year career in sport, okay? And I was very lucky when I was younger, when I first started really playing first team football, that we had a psychologist at Watford FC who honestly helped me so much. He set in place kind of like the foundations that I have carried on not only in football but throughout life for the last 20 odd years. And I think in this day, this sort of like modern age of football, it's so much more prevalent that people are struggling with their mental health, and especially in sport, I see it with some of these young kids. It's a young man's sport. It is, Tom, isn't it? It's a young man's sport, and they just don't seem to have the help that they need.
Not just that though, Ben, just to caveat that and position us for the rest of the episode. It's not always, when we were doing the research, Jamie and I and Frank were talking about it. And we said, it's not just about picking people up from a low position. It's about elevating people from being good and enabling them to be the best. So it works on all levels of the spectrum, doesn't it?
Yeah. And again, I guess you guys have already positioned it really, really well. And what a great experience for you to have such a great experience with psychology, because at times that's not people's experience, right? They don't have a good experience. Then they think, well, all psychology is like that, or all psychologists are like this, and it gets its own stigma around it. But I'm 100% in agreement. So I obviously work in terms of therapy with people around their mental health, but the emotional fitness part is around exactly what you're saying, that we all have emotional fitness. We can all work proactively on that to increase that. And that's the stuff where you don't have to be in crisis. You don't have to be, you know, experiencing something really traumatic. You could just want to improve yourself. You could want to go to your next
Okay, level. So that's actually my leading question then. Okay, so if somebody approaches you to do some work with you, to get some help, to find out more, has that person recently sort of they've been through some sort of diversity, something bad has happened to them, they're struggling mentally? Or do you ever get people who come to you and they're like, no, everything's absolutely fine, I just want to get some building blocks in place to know that if something does happen, how to deal with it,
or just be a bit better?
Yeah, both. And so you absolutely get people that come in crisis, because the issue often is that we all have these coping mechanisms, and they'll all work until they don't, right? Like a global pandemic will throw a spanner in the works with a lot of our coping mechanisms. So all of a sudden, what has been working stops working, and you can no longer ignore the problem. Like, it is really in your face, it's affecting, and it's, you know, destroying relationships, it's destroying you at work on one end of the spectrum. And then on the other end of the spectrum is exactly that some of the people do the best work when they're feeling really robust mentally, they're feeling really solid, and so they're now thinking, how can I elevate this, how can I take myself to the next level? Particularly if you're thinking about leaders, right? They are in charge of, you know, a lot of employees, they are in charge of the culture of their organizations. So these people are really important to be focusing on in terms of thinking about improving their well-being, because it ripples out. So it is both and.
Oh, sorry, I was going to say, you mentioned COVID there. Okay, yeah. So have you noticed in, what is it, 2 years? Are we 2 years down the line
two
now?
Years in March,
has there been an increase in sort of demand?
Exponential.
Really?
Not just for me, I know many psychologists in practice across clinical and sports, but are just full to capacity. We're having to say, we have no room, we're referring on. So many more people are coming forward. And if you think about it, if you think about those coping mechanisms I was talking about earlier on, it makes me think about, we in psychology, there's this term called sublimation, and it essentially just means that we can take some feelings that feel really socially unacceptable. So one of the most common ones, anger. People really struggle to feel angry, and we can turn it into something positive. So people go and have a gym workout, they go for a run, right? All of a sudden, COVID hits and you can't use those same coping mechanisms. You can't go onto the pitch to run off some steam. You can't go to box or whatever it might be. Now you're left with, hold on, I don't know what to deal with. You know, I haven't got these resources in place, and a lot of complex issues are coming.
Can I jump in? I've honestly got a personal story of this. So yeah, sure, exactly what you've just said there. Okay. So when COVID first started, okay, I was quite honestly one of the first person to get COVID. Like I was the first person at Watford FC to get it. I was at home, I was feeling really bad. And we literally within days, it was like everybody started falling down with it. So at first I was thinking, God, please don't be the first one in the press. Like I don't want my name all over everything. Do you know what I mean? But I was feeling rubbish. Honestly, I was feeling so, so bad. And then obviously football got called off really quickly, didn't it? And it was like, nobody, do you know what the big problem was for me at first was I didn't know a time frame of when it was going to get back. So I didn't know whether football would have restarted in 3 weeks, 3 months. I just didn't know. Yeah. And that bit for me, it sort of boggled my head.
But isn't that because you, for lesser, you know, greater or lesser kind of a, what's the word I'm looking for?
Extent.
Yeah, we might have to chop that bit out. But you know, you're used to having a process and a routine. For 20 years, you've been told you report it here at 9 o'clock. Okay, you finish at this. Match day, you go here. Pre-season, we're in this hotel for a week.
Yeah, it's like being in the army.
It's regimented.
Yeah, very regimented. You're waiting to be told what to do. Yeah. Okay, so I've then realised at this point that I started to feel really low at this point. Okay, I didn't know, like I didn't have like the impetus to go and train, which is so weird because I'm the most active. I love going out on my bike. I'll do stuff with the kids out and blah, blah, blah. I was feeling a bit sort of like ill and low anyway kind of thing. But then it was like a cloud in my head almost of like, I just don't want to do anything. And it was so weird because I didn't have a time frame. So then I realized I do all the cycling and the fitness work that I do because I know it benefits my football.
Right.
And then, but because I didn't have the football to go to, I didn't want to do it because it was almost like, well, what's the point?
Yeah, like one fed the other and therefore but then, that's not available.
Exactly, but the normal man on the street, woman on the street, they don't have a football or a sporty job or something to go to. So they have to deal with this every single day of their lives. So that happened to me. And I remember at the time talking to Kate, my wife's really good with stuff like that. She's done psychology course. She went to Manchester Uni, NLP courses, all this kind of stuff. So she knows how to sort of break it down and dissect it a little bit. So I leaned on her massively. But personally, for me, that was like a massive eye-opener of like, whoa, this is,
I guess it's giving you a bit of perspective to people that aren't in your line of work as well.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, they must think, I know a lot of people do think football's all rosy and it's all, do you know what I mean, everything's done for you and all that kind of stuff. It's not that simple. It really isn't. And we'll talk about it in a minute, I'm sure, because in sport nowadays, I honestly think it's essential. It really is essential, Suzanne, that these young players, not even the young players, any player, anybody, they need to have some sort of process of understanding what's happening to them, when it's happening to them, because we have coaches for everything. We do. We have gym coaches. We have like striker coaches. We'll have goalie coaches. You have a manager of your first team coach. You have you're literally a nutritionist. Somebody helping every other facet and aspect of that sportsman's life.
Yeah.
But you don't have, and you still don't really have. It's still a bit of a taboo. You don't have a psychologist on site. Which is bonkers, isn't it?
It is. And can I just go back to what you said about the part with Kate? Because I was going to say, well, what helped, what worked for you? And the fact that it sounds like to me, you leaned into it, right? You didn't push away. Oh, there's this cloud.
I think I did at first. I won't lie. I really did at first. But then then I was like, right, no, you need to really sort of think about this and do it. And that's when I started like, oh, okay, cool.
Because this is often about, I think what facilitates change for me, it's people's willingness to lean into what is uncomfortable, right? What is painful, what I don't want to look at. And when we can do that, we can then start to put words to it, right? So you were able to talk it through to make sense of it. And then it sounds like obviously that shifted for you. You didn't stay in that place, right? You were able to work through to a different place at that point. But again, really honest of you to say, yeah, maybe at first I did push it away. I did try to suppress it. Really common. A lot of people do that. Inevitably, though, it accumulates. So then it's not just this one thing. It's these six things that I've been suppressing and avoiding.
Yeah. And you can't just keep suppressing that. You can't.
No, it goes somewhere. Like our feelings go somewhere. And when they reside in us, often it turns into, you know, a poor immune system. We get ill. We get physically sick. Yeah.
How important is it for people to recognise their coping mechanisms? Because like everybody in their life, everyone has adversity and hardship. Sure. And it was pointed out to me what my coping mechanisms were. And it kind of was a bit of a light bulb moment where, like, for example, I haven't played golf for years, but if I'm feeling low or something, my go-to is to be withdrawn and go to the driving range. Uh-huh. And it's not something that I go, I'm dealing this, I'm going to go to the driving range.
Yeah, it's not but conscious.
And I was like, you know what, that's really interesting. So for me now, if I have the thought process, I kind of think, oh, okay, this is a...
Something's going on in the background.
Yeah, so it makes me more thoughtful.
Yeah, so can we lift up that and have a look at what is making me feel low? Mm. So it is really crucial because, and again, like you've said, some of them we're conscious of, we're aware of. So I know I do this when I'm feeling low, or I know I do this when I want to celebrate. This is how I celebrate. And others are more outside of our awareness, and it does need somebody to point out, it looks like you retreat, it looks like you go silent, it looks like... Because we're not aware of them. They're called defences in psychology. And the whole point of them is they are outside of our awareness. They operate there to help us. But again, it depends. Some of them are really destructive. So if you think about over-drinking, turning to drugs, gambling, which is really on the increase massively in sport, as I'm sure you've probably heard and, you know, it's kind of out there. But a lot all the way through to then really helpful coping mechanisms. And so... Often in my line of work, it's about people being at choice. So the idea that actually until somebody pointed it out to you, you weren't necessarily at choice. You were just acting on habit, right? Mm. And then when you're at choice, when somebody says, oh, I notice you go and do this, then it's your choice to decide, do I still want to keep doing that or do I want to do something different, right? Yeah. And that to me is, I think, ideally part of the work. I'm not ever there to tell somebody you must or you must not do this. I'm there to say, do you realise that you do this? Are you aware? Okay, do you know that there's alternatives? And now what do you want to do?
I play a game called Terraria, right? The lads laugh at me. It's like a kid's game. I'm not joking. It's on my laptop. It's like it's a bit like Minecraft. Yeah?
Okay, yeah. So I'm familiar with Minecraft. Yeah,
and, I love playing it because every time I play it, I'm just calm. And I literally know like the lads are laughing at me. I don't mind it. It's fine. It's cool. And it's such a basic game, right? Uh-huh. But every time I play it, I am just calm.
That helps you. But I noticed that with you, though. I've noticed that over the years. It used to be Zelda, a game called Zelda.
Yeah. I remember that, I was an 80s child.
But when Ben takes him off, and it could be on a Nintendo Switch or whatever, and you kind of go, okay, that's his time.
Definitely a bit OCD, though, mate. Come on, I have got a bit of OCD.
We all have in levels, haven't we? But yeah, you can pick it. It's easy. It's so much easier to, like I say, whether it's conscious or unconscious, but it's so much easier to pick it out with other people.
Sure.
And I like to think of myself as quite an observant guy and, you know, understand people on a basic level. Yeah. But then to not pick this up in myself is like you think, wow, that's incredible.
It makes you human. But self-awareness is a trait of emotional fitness. So we can work on it like a muscle and we can practice things. One of the tools, like a 5-minute tool that I will talk to people about, is name it, frame it, engage it. So name it, what are you feeling? And that does require you to be intentional, right? You've got to stop, you've got to pause. Instead of just going to the driving range, you've got to pause and think, what do I feel?
Yeah.
Where am I feeling it? Framing it physically. This is the other thing. We can often say, I feel angry, I feel sad, and we're completely cut off from actually how do we feel it? Like it's a word, but we're not feeling it. And then engage it visually. And I know we can talk about visualization, but what am I visualizing that I want to do with this feeling? And that is like a quick 5-minute tool that anybody can do to work on their emotional fitness. So you can start really small and you can build up to working with somebody for
I've got a couple of questions here, okay? So do you think, in your opinion, do you think men are better than women at sort of opening up, or vice versa, women are better than men at sort of acknowledging a problem and being open to trying to find a sort of an answer to this?
I think Great question. I think there's a really big answer to that, isn't there, really, which is about socially what we've been conditioned to think is acceptable. Mm-hmm. So right from a small child, you know, often boys are told what? I mean, what's the narrative? You know, don't feel that.
Yeah.
Or boys don't cry, men don't cry.
Man up,
don't,
your hair.
Suck it up. Yeah. I do say a lot of suck it up, to be fair.
Yeah. But again, you will have learnt that. We're not born thinking those things, right? And women, on the flip side, are often told that they're too emotional, that they... So I think it really varies. If I think about the people that I've worked with, actually, when you're sat there one-to-one, a lot of people are ambivalent. They are unsure about opening up full stop. You know, I don't think I've ever worked with anybody that's come in and said, 100%, I want to look at what's been really painful and I've been running from.
I'll tell you everything.
Yeah, like that's really hard to do, right? Like it takes a lot of courage. So I would say, again, it is about once you've fostered that relationship, if you can create an environment where people feel that they can open up, obviously that's where the magic happens and that's where the great stuff comes from.
But just going on to the point about Ben said about footballers and football clubs mm-hmm. have all of these professions at their disposal, but a psychologist might not be on full time or on site. Now, Ben made a very, very interesting comment to me recently when we were talking about the subject matter of this podcast. And it was, I think football clubs are maybe a little bit hesitant because they're almost scared of what a psychologist might do. And I think the phrase you used, what was it? About they don't want to build put a player back together.
It was like an onion. I said they feel like if they peel too many layers back, they won't be able to put them back in time. It's like they haven't got enough time to do it.
Because it's about the here and now. Yeah. Football's about
it's so quick.
One game at a time, two games at a time, and even maybe one season. If you get a player on loan for a season, for example, are the clubs, Ben, I guess this is a question for you both, a little bit scared as to what somebody in your profession might
I think, Suzanne, you answer
do, I
that
don't
because
know.
you've worked in football clubs, haven't you? You've seen it for yourself.
Yeah, so I think it's a great point and I think it speaks to the narrative that can exist in sports. I don't think it's just football. I think, obviously, you hear it in football,
but
of course it... And there is a lot about immediacy and short-term and results and all of that. I often say to people, do you really think that this idea of, you know, let's just avoid the Pandora's box and then we won't have to deal with it, it actually doesn't have some impact. We cannot not behave, right? The way that we, if we're trying to avoid something, it comes out in our behaviours, it comes out in our relationships, it comes out on the pitch, it comes out
at some point,
it
will.
Of course it does. It comes out in the coping mechanisms that you're choosing to use, and all of those can affect performance. So it really varies, I think, on the person that you are sat with, because I've worked with people who have achieved, I mean, like outstanding level of success, and they have been deeply unhappy, deeply miserable, did not feel any joy when they achieved these, you know, accolades that, and so we've got to ask, who is this for? You know, what are we doing if people are not feeling internally any joy from that? But when it comes to, I think, again, then educating, because I think there's that stigma, isn't there, around psychology.
It's a taboo. There is definitely still a taboo.
And trying to help people understand there's the spectrum, right? There's the people that might need really deep work in therapy, and that's one part of it, but everybody can benefit from their emotional fitness. So actually being able to provide that to everybody, this is about them proactively, you are going to prevent, right, prevention better than cure, anybody getting to the point where they are really struggling and then they can't perform. They're actually, I mean, literally I've said to people, you can't perform at this point in time. So, you know, they're not going to, and the doctor's been saying, you can't perform. They're at the point now where actually you've lost the player altogether.
It's an injury. Yeah. It's like having an injury.
And on that, you know, people are more likely to get injured when they're psychologically well. Yeah, absolutely.
So what about players? They might have lots going on in their private lives. They might have high levels of stress or anxiety or whatnot. Yeah. But is it possible for some players just to go on the pitch and perform? That's, they then switch into a different mode and go, I'm now playing football. Because you hear about, I think Paul Merson's been in the press a lot lately about him playing for years and years, serious gambling problem. There was a documentary made on him recently, but he kind of always went on the pitch and did it for many, many years.
I think people can perform and to a very high level. What I will always say is, though, I think they're still missing a next level of potential. So I think, yes, you might see people who can achieve, and I've worked with people who have achieved gold medal, Olympic gold medal, but their potential that they could have taken is still potentially
could have been two capped. Or three gold medals.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. So I do think there's always an impact. You can absolutely go onto the pitch, and some people are able to, but more often than not, especially when I start hearing the real life experience of people, they'll be telling me, I was playing and the ball was at my feet and I can't see, I've got ringing in my ears, like anxiety is so through the roof. And you think, yes, they're performing, but internally, they know they're not performing anywhere near their capacity because they can't see where they're passing the ball. You know, like it, the level of anxiety.
At that point, is that anxiety? Is that nerves? What is that?
That's anxiety.
Is that anxiety? Yeah, is there a difference?
So again, wonderful question. The way that I frame this is between fear and anxiety. So fear and anxiety have the same physiological responses. So say somebody swerves in front of you on the motorway, heart's pounding, maybe you're sweating, maybe
you're
shaking.
I go white sometimes, you know.
Absolutely.
I do, bright white. Like if it's something, a close call in the car or something, bright white.
Absolutely right. So that's fear, right? Anxiety is exactly the same. So you'll have all those same symptoms. But the only difference is fear is about something outside of you. So some car nearly hit you or whatever it was. Anxiety is about, I've got a feeling that's coming up inside of me that feels threatening, like that I can't cope with. So it might be in anticipation of a match. I've definitely, again, worked with players where even in their own team, right, there's frustrations, as you will know, that happen within the team. And they don't know how to deal with that anger that's building up in their team, how to communicate it effectively with their teammates. So they're getting really anxious before a game. It's nothing to do with the opposition. And then, of course, you might have fear about the opposition, about, you know, what
you're losing the battle before you've even started to think about who you're fighting against, kind of thing. That's crazy.
Yeah. But then obviously there are skills and ways that you can deal with this. And again, it sounds counterintuitive. When we're anxious, we want to do things that distract us, right? People do something to move away from it. The answer is actually often moving towards it, being able to lean into it, so paying attention to it. That brings it down, then you can go ahead and move on.
So with nervousness then, so if you've got a job interview, let's put it into football terms then. So if you're potentially a player, it might be a young player and you've got a move to a big club and you're anxious about that deal going through, or is it nerves because it's something good? You want to happen?
It's a really good question because I think often people think when something positive happens, they'll only feel one feeling. Like if some success is achieved, they'll only feel happy. And I worked with somebody and it was a great story, actually. It was the first day I met them. And I'm sure you've worked with, again, because I'm hearing you're very open to psychology, right? You loved the fact that but they came up to me in front of everybody and said, hi, you'll never see me again, right? That was their introduction. And I was like, okay. A couple of weeks later, knock on my door, we did some fantastic work together, and they were in crisis when I saw them. We continued to work together after that sort of crisis had passed, and they went on to completely separate to me, talk about it in the media. They became an advocate for like, this is why you should go and see a psychologist. But one of the things that they mentioned in that media article was when they won a particular trophy, which was a significant trophy, they noticed that they felt sad, right? So they felt happy. They'd actually been like, and they'd played an integral part in this. They also felt sad. And what they did was they went in the kind of changing rooms, in the shower after, cried for, you know, a minute or two, and that was it. They were like, and then I could go on and enjoy the night. Yeah. I could go on and enjoy the celebrations with the rest of the team. I wasn't stuck in this feeling that I was trying to avoid and bury. I just let it go because it obviously brought up some mixed feelings, and that's what happens. We don't just feel one thing, we feel mixed feelings. But they didn't get stuck in it, and then they could go on and really enjoy it. So I think so often we think I shouldn't feel, I shouldn't feel this about achieving something great, but we do, right? That we're humans, we're complex. It brings up
lots of emotions.
Yeah, I get a massive, if we win a game, it's kind of like, you're buzzing, but it's a big old... Oh.
So here's one question for you then, Ben. I understand that. When you're... It's a big moments in your career, when you've moved to Man United, won the League Cup with Birmingham. When you felt these emotions, has it always been euphoria and relief, or has it entered your mind that, do you know what, there's a lot of variables that have come into this, my family support? Has it always been positive, or has it ever been like, you know, you've been flooded with emotion where you felt reflective? Or
I would say, honestly, this is again really good question, because I think when I was younger, I've got this theory, right, that all, not all men, but a lot of men, especially in the sporting arena, their emotional intelligence is very low. It is. It's very low. You don't really understand or how to deal with stuff when it happens to you. Even in your mid-20s, I would say, honestly, not until I was about 30-odd is when I could really start to sort of enjoy my football career. Because I remember, like, being a younger, you know this story yourself. When I was at Man United, like, I would literally go into every game and I'd be thinking, don't mess up, don't cock up, don't make a mistake. And I was going into every game thinking that, right? And that's literally the worst thing you can do. If you're going into a game thinking that, that's you're not going to do very well whatsoever. So like I say, luckily for me, this is after I've met psychologists and spoke to us, but still I couldn't help but think this.
But you had that imposter syndrome at United,
yeah,
didn't
you? Yeah, for sure, I did, yeah. I still kind of went, I remember signing, honestly, Suzanne, and I remember thinking, they're going to see me in training like this next week and go, yeah, what have I done? They're going to be thinking, what have we done here? We've just spent £1 million on this guy. Like, look at the state of this kind of thing. But
do you know that actually it's the high achievers? It's the people that actually, they're the people that struggle with the imposter phenomenon the most, right?
Yeah,
it's the people
okay.
that are really capable. And it's this mismatch between what you're thinking inside, between what other people are saying, right? People are saying, we believe in you, we're going to give you a contract. And inside you're going, oh, don't mess it up.
If I could do this.
Yeah. And then that pervasive fear of being found out,
yeah.
right? Like, that's always watching over my shoulder.
That's the worst feeling. Caught. If somebody comes up to you and says, you're just not cut out for this. Oh my God, that's the,
yeah,
cut my head off dead. I mean, it's horrible.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, that is, sorry, what I was going to say there is, so when I was younger, obviously, like, I'd get these nerves, massive nerves, and I would honestly go into a lot of games thinking, shit, don't mess up, just don't mess up, don't look a dickhead, because this is going to be on telly later, Match of the Day, Sky Sports, the internet, like, everybody's going to see this, like, don't mess up. And it wasn't until I was into my 30s, probably when I turned about 30, I started having kids and a family and all that kind of stuff, you kind of, your mind switches a little bit to, do you know what, this football, it's obviously really important, but it's not the most important thing. Yeah. You've got a family, you've got a wife, you've got all this kind of stuff. That is the most important thing. So then I started to, when I would get the nerves, I would start to go, oh, this is like, nerves mean game time. Yes. Nerves mean game time.
Like,
so
reframing
when,
it.
Yeah, reframing it to, I actually quite enjoy these nerves. So like, now I'll go onto the pitch.
Excitement.
And I'll have nerves. I'll have butterflies. Honestly, I'm getting goosebumps talking about this. It's lovely.
Doesn't that show that you care? Because we talked, like, I know you're similar to me. So we'll talk to our kids about it, and similar age to Ben, you know, 11, 12, 13. And my lad will go, he goes, I've got butterflies. And I'll go, that's good. It shows you care. So it's how you now react to this, okay? Yeah. But, you know, it's excitement.
Yeah, some level of anxiety, some level of nerves is really important for good performance. Like, and you'll have seen this again, if you think about the changing rooms, you'll notice that some people are really flat. Like, they need more energy in their system, and they actually probably do need more nerves. And some people are over threshold and they're like too nervous. They're kind of
bouncing.
Yeah, absolutely. So you do need some for any kind of healthy level of performance. And that's the thing where I was saying with anxiety. We all have anxiety, right? It's part of our survival. So if you didn't, I mean, it's just not possible to not have anxiety, right? It's just how we're designed, but it's about then the level in which, right? So actually keeping it at a healthy level, keeping it at a level that's not going to cripple your performance. And I love the fact that you're saying, you know, there's something about the broader perspective, isn't there, of having a family, where does this fall in the level of importance? And I think
there's a lot of sports fans out there that don't, they don't buy that, like, putting it in that order. They don't understand that. They think football is the most important thing, and then whatever else falls afterwards. And sometimes, like, I say in the Cycling GK vlog sometimes, don't I? Like, it is what it is. Like, we tried to win. I tried my best. I might have made a mistake. The team lost. but never mind, we'll be back next week. And some people really, really pissed off at that, honestly. It's like, I'm just sacking
your best.
It off.
It's as simple as that. Every time you go out, you try your best.
It's as simple as that. I try my best, right? And it's not always going to work out for you. Like, I know I will make mistakes sometimes, but I'll say it to all the young lads, like, do you know, so when you're on the training pitch, okay, like, it's called autopilot, yeah? I call it autopilot. Like, I'm just doing it because it comes natural to me. I've done it for 20 years. I know how to catch a ball and how to dive. I know certain situations because I might have seen it before. And I just do it because it comes naturally to me. But then the problem you've got is that when you go on the pitch, you then start to second guess every single thing that you have worked all week for.
Yeah.
And then that's the bit that makes footballers, and I see it in, I'm not joking, probably 99% of my teammates, I see that self-doubt creep in closer it gets to a match day. Yeah. Friday in particular, they're a bit quieter. They get a bit more sort of insular. They withdraw a little bit.
But that's because you trust your process, don't you?
Yeah,
because autopilot comes from a process. And
deliberate practice.
Yeah, practice. And so you know that you do. This is why I think people might get upset with what you do sometimes. And if the outcome isn't what they want, they might then question Ben's preparation, because you shoot with the GoPro, they go, but is he committed enough? But you know yourself, you go, you train, your behaviours have been very similar for very, very many years.
For sure,
you eat well, you train, look after yourself, the rest will look after itself.
I was just saying about there, the way they get sort of more insular on a Saturday and Friday and stuff like that. So on a Saturday, for example, just before the game, we probably have about 45 minutes in the dressing room, okay? And you see the lads with the big cans on their headphones, and they will not even look up, honestly. And I don't personally, like, I know everybody has to do what they need to do to get themselves in a right mental state to be able to go out there and perform. But I personally think that you need to, it's very hard. I don't think you can just do it. I don't mean it like that. I don't think you can just say to somebody, take them off and do it, because it's not that easy. Like, I think people have to work on stuff to be able to do that kind of thing. But I would just love to see a few more people with them off just interacting a bit more. Do you know what I mean? Like,
I think for me, this is where you do need the group process and your individual. So, like, I would be doing something match day minus one as a group, and I would be thinking as a group, it's psychologically, let's start talking through, like, what's going on, what are people worried about, what's often gets talked about, like, what can you control, what can't you control, what can you influence, some kind of process that you're all able to get on board with when you're thinking about the opposition or whatever it is, where you are in terms of the tournament, whatever it might be. And then, of course, then you've got your individual practice. And I think that is where you were talking about retreating and withdrawing earlier on, right? To what degree it's helpful. Because when I hear you talk, what I hear you, when you get to that point where you're saying, then the self-doubt starts coming in, it's often that we're either in the future, like, if this goes badly, it's all over social media, or it's something about what's happened before. Like, do you remember when I missed that, or I didn't do this?
Is this what I'm saying about the training bit? You don't think about the next 10 minutes or the next hour or tomorrow. No, you're thinking there. About just there, and you're having a nice time, and you're smiling, and you're with your mates. And
so when people have got the headphones on, Ben, because one thing we want to talk about was visualization.
Yeah.
And I remember as a kid, obviously just playing amateur, whatever it was, but I always used to like listening to music and thinking about what was to come, visualizing it. And at the time, I didn't know what that was, but that was the process I used to go through. Is that something you do, visualization? Because you hear as well, the other point is self-talk, when people say, do you hear the lads or do you? You've got this. Come on, we can do this.
Yeah, I think maybe when I was younger, I don't think I've ever really done visualization. I think to put it into sporting terms, okay, do you remember David James, the goalkeeper?
Yeah.
So he got absolutely ridiculed for it. Okay, so in a warm up to games, he would kind of go, he would almost be closing his eyes, and he would be sort of picturing catching the ball, and he would be doing it there, and he would do that, and then sometimes he'd have the ball in his hands, and he'd be sort of smelling it and all that kind of stuff. Is that what we're talking about when we say visualization?
So I think it can be a couple of things. So just to make it a little bit, not to complicate it too much, we have something called mirror neurons in our brain. When you watch a goalkeeper, because you're a goalkeeper, Ben, right, this will come more naturally to you, and it will fire those neurons more. It would fire our neurons because we'd be imagining doing the same behavior, but you have actual experience, the lived experience. So if you were a ballet dancer and you watch somebody perform ballet, those neurons are firing more. So we naturally always mirror, and there's some level of, even if we're not aware of it, there's some kind of rehearsal that's happening. The more intentional rehearsal is probably what you're speaking to here, Tom, where you're saying, I'm actually sat down and I'm intending to think about this from my... And I honestly think people are so different. People are so unique. What works for one person will not work for another. What I always say is, are you willing to give it a go to then be able to discount it? If you just dismiss it straight away, I think that says more about then something else that's going on. Okay. If you give it a go and you go, do you know what? That's not worked for me. So yeah, like him being able to visualize, and often it will be in two ways. Bird's eye view, so you imagining you in a game, but being able to being able to see the crowd, and that visualization running through what they would almost be seeing, and then in your body, right? Like, how would that feel if I make this save, if I dive here, and then refining that and honing that. So as a practice, as a process, we'll go through kind of three phases. And again, this takes a couple of minutes. I'm not talking an hour or it's imagining it from a bird's eye point of view. And then now imagine it from your point of view, and then refining it even more vivid, and then done, right? You're done. And again, it depends. If you're practicing that four times a day versus somebody that practices it once a day, we actually did do studies. We followed up because I think you do need data sometimes to see like who's benefiting from this and who's not. The people that were actually doing the practices were performing way better in terms of their own, if we just stick with them, their own performance from last season. So we could then start to say, well, this is working, right? When you do this, it's working. But I do think it's unique. Not everybody's
going to. Yeah, this is what I know. This is kind of a sports podcast. I think obviously everything we're talking about can be used in the sort of, you know what I mean, socially, it can be used everywhere. Yeah. But if we're just talking about sports, this is why I think it's so important for some of the younger players coming through now. They're almost sort of thrust into the limelight, where they've got millions of like followers on all these social media channels. They know for a fact they're going to be the main story in the newspaper, all this kind of stuff. There has to be something in place, because football clubs just genuinely don't... There's not many, is there, up and down the country? Right. In the Premier League, you're talking about the Premier League here, the best league in the world. Yeah. And for me, the mental side of football, as opposed to the physical, it's at least 50-50.
So do you think we're behind versus... football's behind versus other sports?
I don't know, because I'm not really sure how much psychology goes on in other sports, and that whether it's sort of hands-on and whether they're in the building and all that kind of stuff. All I can say is from my perspective, from being in football clubs, there's only ever been one football club that have had a psychologist, somebody, he wouldn't like to be called a psychologist, but whatever, he would be on site, and that was Watford, and this was, 16 years ago. And since then, I haven't been at a club where there's been an on-site psychologist.
Was that under Eddie Boothroyd?
Eddie Boothroyd, this was, yeah, Eddie Boothroyd. And it was absolutely brilliant. And don't get me wrong, we would have like a one session per week where he would get the whole team and it would be an hour long, and everybody hated it. They hated it. It was like, oh, God's sake, we've got to do this and sit through this for an hour kind of thing. But then that would go back to the sort of the ego and... Sorry, I'm definitely going off on tangents again. But
do you think it was about?
So I think the reason why they didn't want to do it, and I'd have times where I didn't want to do it, because it was the ego. It was like, no, I know better than this anyway. I can do this without all this kind of stuff. But then that was only because I didn't want to admit all that other stuff. So this is when I said to you earlier about emotional intelligence of footballers, I honestly think that probably men in general don't really get emotional intelligence until their late 20s. They fly off the handle. And it's actually really funny to look at position specific as well. So strikers, for me, have the biggest ego, okay? They do. Right. I've seen it for sure. They definitely do. Midfielders, still a bit. Defenders, a little bit more reserved. And then goalkeepers, they're a mixed bag of anything.
Just anything.
Anything goes, whatever, yeah. But you just see them fly off the handle and you just think, what are you doing?
Really
like, calm down. Yeah. So impulsive. Like, they just don't know. There's nothing else they can do other than just throw their toys out.
It comes to different people at different times, though, because when you say, I think it comes to men in particular at a certain point, I disagree. It comes to different people at different times. And it might not come to some people. When you said, I had children and then I kind of almost thought, you know what, this isn't the most important thing. I don't think that's the same for everyone.
Yeah, true.
I think it kind of might dawn on somebody a bit younger, or might never
something
at all.
Something might happen. They might suffer adversity, or could be anything, really. Yeah, sure.
I think people like to, or perhaps don't appreciate just how important it is that what's happened to us when we were early has affected us now.
Yeah.
Like, we've got this idea of, like, I'm me as an adult now, and I was a teenager once and I was a kid once, but none of that's important now. But it is. It's part of our blueprint of our psychology. So I think it really is so dependent on your experiences that you've had. If you've had somebody providing you with a vocabulary, right, being able to say, like, this is what it looks like that's going on, is that right? Or if nobody's doing that, and let's face it, we aren't taught this in school. This happens, like, so early on. It's starting to change, but it's not really.
Yeah.
It's the same with sport, right? It's starting to change. You've got Tottenham with the performance and mental health position that they've, you know, recently launched. You've got Brighton that has a really good psychology program. But I'm in agreement with you. That's not the majority, no. Right? This is the minority we're looking at. That across the board, in terms of society, we need to start doing more psychologically. And it was interesting. You said you see it at least as 50-50. Right? Like, for you, it's just as important as your physical health.
Yeah.
It makes up half of your performance, mm-hmm. is what you're saying.
Yeah. Right. It's like, it's another attribute. It's another. If you had to build, like, the perfect sports person, okay, for example, like, left foot, like, out of 100, you know what I mean? Sort of like right foot, heading, speed, like, acceleration, the mental part of it would fill almost like. But then you can break down the mental parts toward it, dealing with pressure at big moments. Somebody might charge him down. Does he remain calm? Is he got his head up? Because that's all mental.
That's all composure.
Yeah. So, like I say, composure is another element of the mental bit. Yeah. But I reckon that mental tab would have just as many components to it as what the physical tab would have to it.
Well, and we need more people like you talking.
It's true,
about
though.
This,
it's
true. Right?
It is. So, it's completely true. But they footballers just don't like to make a thing of it. It's like, it's still so taboo. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. So when you, back in the day at Watford under AD Boothroyd, and you had somebody come in and talk, a psychologist, and you were kind of like, and a lot of the lads were like, can take it or leave it. What about motivational talks? Because they're linked, I presume. And would the lads treat that differently? Because I remember some reason, or I remember the story sticking with me, when you had, not a footballer, I think it was Sean Fitzpatrick, wasn't it? The all black came in. This was 15, 16 years ago.
Yeah.
And I remember you saying you were just, this guy, how he talked, you were blown away.
Yeah, I think the beauty of people that can do stuff like that is, because they're kind of well known, I've already built a picture up of who this guy is. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of relative to me, and I can understand it a bit easier. And I think that's what you need. Take this the right way, please, but you might not be the best psychologist for a certain person.
I 100%
because of how you are able to get on with that person. You might not have the rapport that somebody else might be able to strike up with that person. And I think you can have somebody come in and do that, but it's not going to apply to everybody in the same way as certain people might apply
so
to people.
So with a motivational speaker then, surely a large part of that is psychologically based, or because it's not just go and get them today, lads, and banging on the dressing room doors anymore. It's about team talks now seem to be, from what I gather, a lot more methodical and a lot more strategy. And surely they're linked, Suzanne.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you've got somebody that is aware of their psychology as a coach and they're going in and giving a talk, not necessarily bringing a speaker in for motivation. It sounds like you had a speaker brought in, right? But as a coach, you've got so many duties to contend with, right? The team dynamics, the dressing room, picking, like, selection, delivering the bad news, the kind of motivational talks beforehand. So how can you not need a space to be able to reflect upon that and to think about that? And I am in 100% agreement with you that, for me, it's about who has the best relationship, because we know this in therapy too. The number one important factor of whether it's going to be a success or not is on the alliance, which is the relationship. So actually, you could have an outstanding psychologist and they do not gel with this person is not gelling with them, they are not going to have an impact. Mm. So it the number one thing for me when I say to people in order to help them find a psychologist, or, you know, they say, right, I want to do therapy, what do I need to... that's the number one thing you need to be looking at in terms of the relationship with the person.
Can I jump in quickly? Well, I don't know how far we're into this at the minute, but I told you this was going to be, I told you this was going to be one of the most interesting, and I hope everybody listening or watching on YouTube or on Spotify are enjoying it, because this is Balton. We're going to go for a lot longer yet. Don't worry about that. Okay. So what is it then that you think sport in general just won't get on board with? What is it about psychology that sport just won't sort of adopt yet?
Again, it's a great question, and I think there's a lot of different factors here. It's never just one thing, is it? There is so much pressure in terms of results and the quick wins, and so we've already started talking about, you know, investing in psychologists and what does that look like. I think there's just really a huge taboo and a misunderstanding of what psychology is, and psychologists haven't always been great at resolving that. Like, I think we can't just put it on a system. We can say, actually, we're responsible for this in some ways. You know,
measure it, do you mean?
No, I mean that, like, I think for a long time, people were brought in as a psychologist to fix what's going wrong.
Yeah.
And actually, that's not how psychology works. Ideally, you know, it's embedded in the culture.
From the start.
Yeah, and you're working with, as you were just saying about the relationship, I might work with the coach and they will then go and run this workshop. I could have delivered the workshop, but actually they've got the relationship and they know their players so much better, right? They're working with them day in, day out. So I think there's also this idea about, like, I think there can be a concern. I've also worked in different sports where the coaches have felt their own personal beliefs have meant that they've made it very difficult for me to then access players and other members.
Old school, you mean?
Yeah.
Really. Barriers, so, then. Really.
There is, I see it. Like, even in football now, you'll have the old school coaches, like, and they'll be like, you don't need any of that shit, just sort of suck it up and get on with it kind of thing. And it is, you see it all the time.
You know, people watch what we do, not just what we say. So if, as a coach, you are openly, you know, accepting and embracing the psychologist, that has such a massive, profound effect on the rest of your team. If you are disparaging, derogatory, and, you know, I've also had, you know, and this is really true, I've had coaches who to the group would make it very difficult, and then privately, when I've gone to leave an organization, say, so can we work together now, right? And so there's this real internal barrier for them about what it means to work with a psychologist. I think it can be fear. I think, you know, coaches hold a lot and they are expected to hold a lot, and I think they can be fearful about opening up and sharing that information. But again, this is where, you know, it is confidential. And I think there's a lot of dynamics that go on with stakeholders and technical directors. And, you know, but there's so much that coaches get from being able to sit and work with a psychologist.
Have you ever got to the point where you've had to pull a coach aside and said, basically, stop being a prick, would you?
No, I've never.
Let me do my work, all right, and stop putting me down.
No, I've never. I've had to address, like, it seems like you keep cancelling our appointments. Is there something going on here? And again, I think that speaks to, you know, I was talking about the accumulation. Like, when we don't know how to deal with something, when we don't know how to address something, we avoid, right? We escape. We just try to avoid it. And so for me, it's always much cleaner to kind of just be able to address it and say, what's going on here? Or it seems like you've got some mixed feelings, or can we look at that? And obviously some people will, some people won't, but that is my approach. I'm very upfront about that.
So when you go into a building at a sports organisation, let's use a football club, obviously, when people find out what you do, do they try and change their behaviour to almost get a psychologist, let me just put on a bit of a front here, or let me behave a certain way so I'm kind of together, or...
Yeah, I mean, again, it is the general public will hear you're a psychologist and go, I'm not going to say anything, or, you know, I actually went to look for a new car recently, and then he asked what I did, and we'd already been, like, working, you know, like, talking for about half an hour, and he was like, oh, okay, like, I shouldn't say anything more, like, you know, we're not mind readers. I can promise you we're not mind readers.
It feels that way sometimes.
I know, but I think that's the other thing, like, I only, like, earlier on when we were talking about... of course, like, I have done training and I'm really interested in human behaviour. So there's a lot in terms of body language and all of that that you can read. But I have a really, again, like, internal ethical belief that I don't work with somebody unless I've got the permission to work with them. So I'm not going to be sat there analysing somebody because they've not given me the permission.
Must come naturally to you though.
Not to, and like as in to intervene in a way that you would as a psychologist.
Yeah.
Like, of course I'm going to have judgments because I'm human, and I don't think that the goal is not to get rid of your judgments, right? That's, it's often to take a moment and go, what's that telling me about me?
Okay,
like, what
yeah,
am I expecting
yeah, yeah.
here in this relationship? But of course, I'm human. I have judgments and I have thoughts and I have training. So that helps me to think about certain things. But I don't have the permission to work with people. And I think, you know, if you don't get that permission, this is where it can get really tricky. And people feel intruded upon. And they should do, right? It's like you wouldn't do that in any other area of the world. You wouldn't just go in and start telling somebody. It's going to get your back up, right? If, unless you've asked for feedback. You don't want people to get
how
it.
How mad so. Is it though, thinking, right? So you're the psychologist and say you're working with somebody, you just think, you must have had it, you just think, I just don't like you. I really don't like you. But imagine, like, you've got to, you're the psychologist. So you've surely got to process that into your head and say, what is it I don't like? Why am I thinking I don't like this person? And I have to keep it on a level, like I have to still go off the hymn sheet and do it all in the right way.
Well, I think that's a beautiful point because this is such a taboo in psychology, right? And I've just been recently talking with a group of psychologists about this and saying it's really important that we talk about the people we really like and the people we don't like, right? That's telling us something. And more often than not, it's not the person. In my experience, it's what they're doing in the relationship.
Yeah,
so let's say I'm here to help you and you're putting up so many barriers. And I've said this to players, like, you can keep the wall, that's fine, but I'll be useless. So what's going on that you want to sabotage this already? Like, is that a part of you? Do you sabotage things? And they'll be like, oh, actually, I see a pattern here, right? Because we are excellent at sabotaging yeah. ourselves, right? Mm. But it's never the person that you don't like. It's often what they're doing.
Their traits. Making
the making it difficult
their
to
behaviors.
Connect. Because we want to connect, right? We're humans. So
very
it's, not,
interesting.
It's not them. It's what they're doing often as a protection mechanism.
So when you talk about body language yeah. and you said about, you know, giving people access. So Ben, a question for you. Body language in sport, we're talking about internally within a team and what making yourself better. Let's look at the opposition now. Ben, without giving away the tricks of your trade, because you're still currently playing, are there any techniques that you've used over the year, body language, mental games, against opposition?
I wouldn't say I've necessarily used them against them, but I've always found it very interesting to try and notice what they are and try and sort of decipher it, sort of thing. So I've got a couple stories. So say it was a Birmingham City Carling Cup final against Arsenal. Okay, so the game is about to start. We're in our changing room still, basically. Right. But what they do at Wembley is they used to open up the doors of the two changing rooms that are literally looking at each other.
Right.
And so Arsenal were over there, we were here, and we were lined up, and we were looking straight at them. Okay, and I'm getting goosebumps. It's ledge. I love it. So yeah, it's so good. It's yeah. so good. So we're looking at the Arsenal. They both open up at the same time, so we both get to see each other at the same time. And
the gladiators.
Yeah,
see
it's
each
a bit
other.
Like that. It's a bit like that. It's awesome. And Stephen Carr was our captain, and he was brilliant. Stephen, honestly, he's like a leader of men. I would have followed him anyway. He was incredible, and he spoke so well, and he got everybody going. Yeah. And the doors opened up, and straight away he just went off. And when I'm getting mad goosebumps, and he's doing all the usual boys, and then he's gone, right, lads, and everybody just shut up, eerie silence kind of thing. He said, look at that change of room. And we all looked, and it's all these Arsenal megastars. You've got Van Persie, you've got all these boys there,
they're in their
kind
pomp,
of thing.
Then, weren't they?
They're in their pomp, they're doing really well.
Yeah.
But they kind of looked like kids, like boys, like, do you know what I mean? A bit sort of, you know what I mean? And he said, look, you see them boys, they might have a lot of talent. They might have a lot of talent, but they haven't got what we've got in this dressing room. And as he said it, honestly, every
I'm
one of us.
I'm getting goosebumps.
I'm mad. My eyes are watering. Like he said it, and the roar, oh my God, honestly, the roar from our starting 11, everybody behind it, the whole team, brilliant. The physios, the masseurs, everybody. Yeah. Just jumped up, whoa, and every one of us just like adrenaline levels went through the roof, honestly. Yeah. And I remember it like to this day exactly. Every single word he said, it was absolutely incredible. And it's funny actually because there's a masseur that works for Watford now, Kieran. He's one of my best mates, and he actually was the masseur for Arsenal on that day. So we used to work for Arsenal. Yeah, it's a brilliant story. And we need to get him on the podcast one time, because he tells the story in reverse. He tells the opposite side of the story, okay?
Oh, I bet that's good.
It's so good, honestly. Yeah. It's so good. So his version obviously is the doors open and you were like a bunch of animals.
Yeah.
Like, honestly,
you're
this
wild.
Yeah, yeah, wild. Yeah. He said, you were like a bunch of animals. He said, you're all jumping around, the noise. And he said, and we kind of like looked at each other as if to say, like, phew, like almost laugh it off. He said, but everybody almost did it. And then straight away almost just went, shit. Like, like nobody could, like, he said, none of them could look at each other. Everybody was just a bit like, oh shit. And then we went out, we won the game 2-1. Like, we were mad underdogs. I think we were 16-1 to win the game. But yeah, it's we're going back to the question of body language. That for me was watching them. I can still see the door open and see them. And it was the way that they kind of tried to laugh it off.
Yeah, tried but to then dismiss it.
They, then within literally half a second of looking at each other, they couldn't keep it up. And I was thinking, oh shit. All right, like, yeah.
1-0.
We might have a chance here. We might, 1-0 before the game's even started. But it's interesting you asked that question there, because I did actually just read in the press the other day, so the new Manchester United manager, so there's been a lot made at the minute of Manchester United. They're playing a bit poorly and all this kind of stuff. But one of the big things that they've been talking about a lot is their body language, the player's body language. Mm-hmm. And Ralf Rangnick apparently has gotten in a psychologist specifically to improve the player's body language.
Second appointment, wasn't on, it?
Like, yeah, really, exactly. Yeah. So is that, in your opinion, a big thing? Is he going to be there just solely for the body language? Is he going to be there on campus to try and help the players mentally, or all that kind of stuff?
I don't obviously know the psychologist, and I don't know what the strategy is. I would doubt it would be just body language. I would imagine there would be more to it than that. But again, body language is an interesting thing, right? Because again, it's conscious and unconscious. You're consciously aware of some things, like how you're holding the bottle right now, all of that sort of stuff. But in other ways, we do things that are really unconscious. And they're tells, they give away information. And so at times, obviously, again, if you're not aware of that, you need somebody to reflect that back to if you want to change it. So I imagine with the psychologist going in to look at what's going on. But it's interesting, even that idea of you guys in the changing rooms, you know, earlier on I said about some teams that go flat. Like, there was something about your energy and, you know, that vitality in you, and all of a sudden there's this flatness in them, and it's like their energy's drained.
Yeah.
And then you've gone out and you've taken that out onto the pitch. And the other thing it makes me think about is team cohesion, because it sounded like, and again, this has been my experience working in sport, you all know much better than me here, it's a family. Like, it becomes, and I don't mean that in a, you know, families are functional and dysfunctional. We all have our own. family. But it's, you spend so much of your life with these people.
Probably more than with your family.
Yeah. And you are away, traveling, you are missing really significant events, or you're experiencing significant, like your birthday there with them, Valentine's Day, you're there training, all of that sort of stuff. It's about the team cohesion too. So that culture that's like created in there is so important.
You said something really interesting earlier, actually, was it said, so you spoke about the fact that we only ever prepare for the worst. So with psychology and all that kind of stuff, with the coaching, with like the way football works and stuff, you don't ever prepare for being 2 or 3 nil up.
Yeah.
Okay. You don't. So this leads me on to my next point is, Jose Mourinho has been very sort of vocal in the last week or so, especially since they had a, I think it's the local derby against Juventus. They were, I think, 2 or 3 nil up. They ended up losing the game 4-3. And he came straight out afterwards to say, basically, the first thing he said was, my team is not mentally strong enough to hold on to that lead. My team is not mentally strong enough. And I've looked into it a little bit, and he's actually got a little bit of a sort of a checkered past, really. So,
track record.
So it is past clubs. So Tottenham, Manchester United, Chelsea. He's done exactly the same thing. He's coming out after games and he's questioning the mental strength, the resilience of the players. What sort of... That can't have a good effect on the players, because they read everybody reads everything they do. They read Twitter, they read Instagram, they read the comments. We'll go into that in a minute, actually, because I think that's a massive thing to talk about. But that can't be a good thing for Jose Mourinho to be coming out and saying this after games.
Yeah, I think, again, it's so, it's so unique to each player, isn't it? Because some players I've heard from, they'll say, I look over, I see the manager and they're not doing anything on the sideline. I need more energy from them. I need more feedback. Other people will say, complete distraction, like, or that feels like an attacking comment. Yeah. And yeah, and then you've ruptured something. For me, it's, we have in our relationships, particularly if you think about coach and player, coach athlete, there will be lots of ruptures. There'll be lot, because if you're actually, you know, doing it properly, if you're really showing up and you're being
it real, happens a lot more than people think, honestly. Yeah, a lot more. It's actually the norm, I'd say.
It is. Right? But the key bit is how you repair it, right? How you're able to go back to one another and say, yeah, look, or how, you know, to be able to ask your changing room, like, what's going on? Like, the, you know, I know we've talked, or at least one of the kind of questions was about losing the changing room and what happens. And I think that does happen, right? I've seen it happen. But it's then the coaches or the players' willingness to address it and to have the honest conversation to really communicate it and say, when you do this, this is how it affects me. Or, you know, when you're going out and saying that we've lost it and we're not mentally strong enough, this is the impact it's having.
Again, this is part of the problem, though, that you were saying earlier. You only ever get to do this once it's gone to pot, don't you? So yeah, you only ever go and address something, especially in sport. Well, not especially in sport, that's a rubbish thing to say, but you will only ever go and do something about it when you're in the threat of relegation. You're losing, you're on a bad streak or something like that, which is...
And the thing about, you know, not preparing for going up, the reason I said that is because actually that is really, if you look at, again, if you watch certain, the matches that I'm thinking of that I've watched, there's this really like fragile period after you've scored in that. Oh,
when you go 2 or 3 nil up, you mean? Sorry.
Yeah. You're then more likely to concede, right? Because people lose their head when they've scored two.
It's
right?
like it's a relief just, thing, though.
Switch off,
vulnerable.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
So very, very, this is one thing we've touched on in the past, but really interesting question for you, Ben. And Suzanne, I'm sure you'll have input here. So Wigan won the FA Cup final a few years ago and got relegated. Is that right?
Yep.
When you won the League Cup with Birmingham, you got relegated. And when we were preparing for the podcast, I read a little bit about this gold medal syndrome and not preparing for the win. So you were not expected to win that cup final against Arsenal and you got relegated.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that, Ben.
This is brilliant, honestly. What a question. Well done, Tom. You're like the psychologist. Well done. So that's a really good question because I remember winning the game, right? And I can't put an exact time on it or whatever, but I remember for quite honestly, for weeks afterwards, I was so drained emotionally, mentally, physically, like everything was just drained out of me and every other player as well. We were so, like, we were on our knees, honestly. So I think we went on some crazy run. So the cup final was in early March, is it, or late February?
Yeah.
And literally after that, we had a probably an 8 or 9 or 10 game period where we just lost every game. Lost every game because we were just gone. Yeah. We were absolutely gone. The euphoria of winning this trophy against all odds at Wembley, do you know what I mean? Yeah. Against Arsenal. And then afterwards, we were shot to pieces. And that's the reason, honestly, that is the reason we got relegated. And we had a very good team. We did literally, virtually every player in that Birmingham team went and got a move to like a Premier League team because they were good players. But that, again, is where the brain and the body just took over and was just, no, we can't carry this on.
Yeah, and people don't, I think, appreciate the importance of the reset and recharge in like a performance cycle. So you've done probably loads of prep, right, in the build-up to having to compete and, you know, win this title. And then afterwards, where's, you know, the psychology doesn't stop. You do need processes for resetting and recharging before going back into review. And I think not enough of that is given attention. And people will talk about it across sports. You know, they'll win Olympic titles and then they retreat for 2 days in their hotel room and don't come out. Like,
but it's 4 years, Suzanne. Sorry to interrupt. It's 4 years. So imagine the process for you, Ben. You finish the season. You start again in 3 months. Yeah. You finish an Olympic cycle. 4 years.
But I think they're both difficult in different ways, right? Like the amount of people that play football that I will hear that, you know, like they've not had a break consistently, if they're playing in different tournaments internationally, different, they're not, it's so fatiguing that if you don't have proper emotional fitness practices in place for the reset and the recharge, you hit burnout. Like it's a boom or bust. And I appreciate with Olympics, 4 years, there's a massive build up. And then, yes, you drop off the cliff. But I think it's similar in the same way that you still need a process. You still need something to be able to go to. Like, you've appreciated your processes that aren't just about sport now. They've come into your life. You still need something to go to prepare you for after that.
So for the end, take at the end of the season, for example, when the season finishes, do you think then it's the perfect opportunity, if possible, to go on holiday, for example, and I mean switch off, completely switch off. Don't watch football. Don't think about football. Don't stay out the gym for a week or something. Yeah. Is that what you...
I do, but I think... And actually, a lot of people said to me during COVID, although it's really difficult, some people said it was the best time of their life. Honestly, the professional players...
Honestly, COVID, I'm not joking, I loved every second of it. When I got that first difficult period out of the way, where I was a bit poorly, a bit ill, struggling with everything, just the whole new, and again, sorry, going back to that, no structure, no like framework of doing stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like,
You've always got to be somewhere.
The kids were off, we were off, there was nothing.
Chaos.
Nothing was in place. It was complete chaos. And then it took us probably 2-3 weeks of going, right, let's actually just set a timetable out of stuff we're going to do and try and stick to it. And then once we had done that and it got into place, everything then, it was like, oh, okay, we've got something to, we should be doing this
now. Mate, honestly, I think that was some of the best memories of my life and the worst, because there were things we did, like, as a family, little things. We did 2 nights a week. We did the Marvel movie franchise. And it was like, do you know what?
It was that thing. Brilliant, wasn't it?
And I look back and go, and it was like, we just enjoyed that so much. And then you look at kids at school and you're working, and that was so stressful, and the arguments in the house. And I would challenge anyone to say that they were unavoidable. Yeah. I think they were unavoidable, those arguments.
Yeah, they were,
And it's really quite, you know, the best and the worst, isn't it? It's not like you tend to get one without the other. And I think you're speaking to traditions and rituals. So we found our own rituals. We found our own structure. But giving yourself the permission to just go, God, okay, this is new. Right, nobody's ever had to deal with this.
Yeah.
And I think that's it. We don't give ourselves permission enough often. Or like you say, you know, you're regimented. So there's this sense of actually you just have to turn up and you just have to do what you're being told. So where is then the self-choice there? Where is the, you know, a lot of the times when I've worked with people and they will start off by saying, as if like I'm going to tell them what to do. And I say, what's the problem you're having that you want my help with? And that's just mind blowing to them, because I'm all of a sudden saying, well, you're your own person. How is it I can be of help to you?
Yeah.
I'm not here to tell you what you need to change, but all of a sudden you've got choice and you don't
you
have
can
that.
Still, you can still, even though, like, so let's take a footballer, for example. We get told where to be at what time, but you can still take ownership of whilst you're there.
Absolutely.
So I see a lot of footballers, I do, Suzanne, who will come in and they are literally just sitting around waiting to be told what time to start activation or what time they're going to be going out for training. They won't take it upon themselves to go and do a little bit more. Do some more prehab, like go in a bit earlier, work on something else, work on another sort of part of the... So you can still, regardless of what industry you're in or sport or whatever, you can still have ownership of everything. I like to think like I'm a business at times. Like, I'll go in and I'll do a bit more bike session or a bit more strengthening of this and this, because it will help me football, but on the bike as well, for sure. But that you still have to have a bit of ownership of everything you do, right?
Yeah, I think it's so important for you to be invested in it.
Yeah,
like, you're not just a pawn. You're not a commodity.
Getting pushed and pulled.
Doing. Yeah, you are actually, you're invested and it's meaningful to you, right? And it is essential then to have those people that you can see, because, like I said, we copy what we see. Mm. We don't always copy what we're told to do. Yeah, but also as a human, right, we don't like to be told what to do, surprisingly.
Yeah.
You know, actually that leads to one of two things. People comply and they go along with it, and at some point they defy and they, you know, they vote with their feet, or they don't stick to the training program, they don't stick to the healthy eating, they don't, because they're looking for some way to express themselves because they don't feel like they have ownership.
So leads us on to the next question, I guess, which is winning mentality. So you don't play 18 to 20 years in the Premier League without doing the basics and doing above and beyond as well. So with that in mind, it's not just about match day. And I'd like to talk about your opinion, both of your opinion, on a winning mentality and what makes that.
Okay, so yeah, I come from, so I've got two brothers and a sister. Okay, so our household was very competitive.
I'm one of four too.
Yeah,
so I can
very
appreciate.
Competitive. Yeah. I was the youngest as well, so I was always kind of like yearning to be up there with my brothers and stuff like that. So no matter what it was when we were kids, it could be anything, Mario Kart, Tiddlywinks, didn't matter. It was the end of the world if you lost. It was genuinely the end of the world, right? And I honestly think that's probably the biggest. Not the main reason, but the biggest driver of me being a professional sports person is because I'm so pathetically competitive. It's a joke, right? Honestly, it is an absolute joke. I make a competition out of everything in training every single day. It will be, we'll go out for goalkeeping and I will make sure I have got the cleanest hands. So we'll do a set of volleys and I'll be watching the other goalies. You drop one, you're losing 1-0, you're losing 2-0, I'm winning, and I'll do it with everything, yeah? And I make sure. But I honestly think that is, I've made it so ingrained in me that that is the bit where I don't get me wrong, I buzz off winning, I do. But I know in a team sport, you can only do so much. Sometimes the team won't win. And I've got very good as I've got older of just going, it kind of is what it is. You know what I mean? You can't win everything all the time. But as long as you know you've done all you can do, that's all you can ask, right?
Yeah. Well, these are really important traits of people that are, as we would think about it, great leaders, right? Actually, that people who have this passion for what they do, but they are forever wanting to get better. And when you talk about competition, part of that is integral to that. And that's why I think, you know, there can be destructive competition, which is really unhealthy and actually cripples a team and it breaks apart a team. And then there's the healthy competition. And if you can foster that in the way that you're doing, you're almost competing mentally against, right? You're the goalies or you might.
Is that a healthy thing to do?
It's a healthy thing to do, absolutely. Okay. As long as it's not tipping over into the point where you are finding it actually is a hindrance, right? Okay. And it doesn't sound like it does, but, you know, for other people, it might be. They might say, you know, we might think about more of a perfectionistic trait where they absolutely cannot lose, right? And then it, because like you said, that's unrealistic, right? So we're not setting ourselves up for failure, but these ways of competing against ourselves or our teammates are really a healthy thing to do. And it sounds like, and again, there's a lot to be said for, you know, your early experiences there with your brother's sister that's fostered that, that's, you know, cultivated that in you. And then to be able to take that and cultivate that in a team is great. And that's I think where, you know, again, across sports, you've got your Michael Jordan and your Scottie Pippen. Like, they need each other, right? They are going to then make each other better. So you do want that. That's a healthy thing. I've worked with people that will say, we don't want any conflict. And I say, no, like, you're missing a trick if you do that. It's how to actually keep it where it is healthy and it's not going into destructive competition.
Yeah, we had Aaron Ramsdale on last week, the Arsenal goalkeeper. Yeah. And I was listening to him and I was thinking, I do that. And he was saying the same sort of thing. Like, it's weird because there's a thing in goalkeeping where the kind of the first choice goalkeeper will go first and sort of set the standard almost. So if it's a set of volleys, the first choice goalie goes first, second choice goes second. And I'm a big believer in that. I like to go first and I like to set the standard and show
ritual.
I like to show people, like, look, that's like, because every time now, they're all younger than me. So, like, all the other goalies are like, they're
even
much
younger. The goalie coach is younger than you.
The goalie coach, yeah. So I like to go, right, that's that. And I'm the oldest one here, okay? I'm 38 years old. You cannot fall short of that, all right?
Yeah,
and
I like
to set a bar for them. And Aaron was sat there and he was saying, I don't care about the order. I'll go last, I don't care. I'll go third, I don't care. He says, but I will make sure that I have the best hands. I will have the best hands. And I'm just thinking, that's class. This kid's 23 years old, by the way. It'd be wicked if you could sit and have a conversation with him, because he has got his head screwed on like you wouldn't believe, hasn't he, Tom? He's got his priorities in the right order. He has the best outlook on life I've seen from a young footballer. Honestly, it was so good, so refreshing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Massively.
But can I just say on that point, like, it would be interesting to hear about the other goalies in both of your respective teams then, to find out, like, for them, do they like that you go first and set the bar?
I've never thought about that.
Actually, in his team, would they prefer it if he went early and now they've got something to compete against?
Okay.
Or actually, I don't know what Aaron's going to pull out the bag here, so I've got to bring my A game. Because who knows what, like, it'd be interesting just to
see. That would be really interesting to see.
Do you think you're a leader, Ben?
I think I can be a bit too harsh sometimes. with the other goalkeepers, not necessarily with the outfield players. I think I have this ingrained belief in my head that the goalkeepers are a little bit mentally stronger than the outfield players. I really do, because we spend so much more time in our own head by ourselves.
It
so,
is a unique position. Yeah, in it's my a experience.
Very unique yeah. position.
So what makes a good leader for you? For you, like captain wise, and what makes a good leader for you in your opinion?
I think empathy. For me, empathy is the biggest part of being a leader. You have to be able to judge every single situation differently and be able to talk and communicate with that person after something might have just kicked off, happened, but you need to know how to deal with it that's going to apply to them in the best way possible.
Depends what you're leading there as well. If you're leading a group of a squad of 30 men or 30 yeah, women, sure, yeah. or, you know, it's very different, isn't it? If you're like, look at us, we're a team of four, or if you're running a business which has got 200 employees. Yeah. But same question to you, Suzanne. What makes a good leader to you?
So I agree with you. Empathy is, and this is where I think it gets a bad rap, right? We talk about it as a soft skill.
Empathy, yeah, really?
We talk about people skills as soft yeah, skills, okay, and yet yeah. they're what go on to be the most successful people,
yeah, for
the
sure.
people who have mastered that. I think they've got these really contradictory qualities. So I think they're confident, but they're humble. Like they can, like we were talking about earlier on, they are not just open to feedback, they seek out feedback. So they don't just, you know, they're not just curious about, okay, if somebody comes to me with feedback, they are hungry to know. They've got that thirst to be better. Like they are realistic. You know, you were talking about earlier on about the wins and the losses, and they don't get stuck in the loss to the point where it then affects the rest of their season or the rest of their week. So they're able to use the feedback in a way that is effective and then move forward with it. They're engaging. I think you can go to them. I think they are systematic, right? They've got like a plan. Or if you think about whether it's as a footballer or the coach, they've got a methodology, but they can be flexible.
Yeah.
Like they're not. It's when we get rigid that actually things get broken because we can't bend.
There's no set rule for what is a good leader then, basically. You've got to have a bit of all sorts.
Yeah, it's like it's this mixed bag of things, but but you're not chaotic, right? People feel there's a consistency, but you are flexible. You're not going to, you know, you're not going to my way or the highway. You are willing to do that empathy piece, which is, okay, if I put myself in your shoes, how is it from your view? Right?
Yeah,
what do you need?
This is why I've just said there, I'd like to think empathy is a big thing, but then you've fully got in my head now about the other goalkeepers and what they...
Oh, no.
Fully got
He's
in my
broken.
Head. Because
but it's a question.
I genuinely have never considered what they think about that, yeah. whether they like that kind of me going first. And
so here's your emotional fitness workout, right?
Yeah.
You go and ask them when you go back to your...
I think part of that's ego-based for you, Ben.
For sure, it is. Like, I don't think you can be a sports person without having an element of an ego.
Oh, 100%.
You have to have some sort of an ego. You do.
But I think that's why a lot of British athletes... Look at the most successful British athletes in the last 10 years, okay? Who are we going to say? Lewis Hamilton.
Oh, heck yeah. Well done, yeah.
Andy Murray.
Yeah.
Is that British?
Yeah, Andy Murray, British, yeah.
Yeah, British, yeah, Andy Murray,
footballer right, Rooney, Gerrard,
particular,
yeah,
come to mind, and a lot of the British public have a certain view on those guys.
Yeah, they're not
that
big
isn't
fans,
particularly positive. There is a lot of people that adore them, but I think it's because people think he's arrogant, he's cocky. And hey, look where they are! You've got to have an element of that in you, and a little bit spitefulness, a little bit selfishness. To get to that level, I really think it's important.
And again, is it selfish or is it, again, this...
Drive?
Yeah, I think, again, the way that we frame it, because language is important, but the ability also to distinguish that. I know you mentioned social media earlier on. If people are seeing you as arrogant, your ability to, you know, detach yourself from their opinion of you and have a solid sense of who you are and what you're about. Like,
they're
that's
leaders
the
as
healthy
well, though.
People.
They're yeah. leaders as well, so it goes back to being leader. Lewis Hamilton is almost like the head of his team.
Yeah.
And the arrogance, the confidence kind of thing. Like, look at
yeah,
me.
That's it. Is it confidence? Is it arrogance? You know, yeah. I think we confuse things and then it shuts down people,
yeah.
right? Like, saying somebody's confident is very different to calling them arrogant.
You know, in football, like when they, you know that, what's the film where they go, the inches are everywhere. Pacino, that one, you know, that film.
Any Given Sunday?
Any Given Sunday.
Oh, when what they, movie?
When, like, I've had
I
it, honestly. I've
no.
had, you've never, you, you'll have heard
I've
this.
Heard of it,
you've
I
heard
haven't.
The speech where yeah. he goes, the inches are everywhere. They're in the thing, blah, blah, blah. I've had it at football clubs where we have been in a dire situation, right? And then they've gone, we've got a video to show you, lads. And then Al Pacino appears any given Sunday, and everybody just goes, oh, for God's sake. It's like, that is like the last straw. That's the last resort.
That's
that
broken
is.
Them.
Lads, please just win. Come on, please.
When you see Pep, for example, you see, what I like about Pep is what, when you see bits behind the scenes that they feed you, you kind of go, what I love about him is that he's stylish, flexible. Seen him, like, clips of him in the changing room shouting and giving a bit, and then you hear him delivering a message which is concise and to the point, and he judges the situation. He'll go, this is what we need to do. Boom, gone, we're out.
Yeah.
And I just think that's brilliant to have that flexible style.
Have you ever watched Ted Lasso?
Yes.
Have you
recently
seen it?
So everybody kept saying, I did my training, some of my training in America, and the Americans were saying, you need to watch Ted Lasso. It's making me think about, like, over there.
Is Ted Lasso big in America?
Well, it's big in the people, like, with the psychologists that I know, but they were saying, like, is that what it's like in a club? So I have seen it, and I binged it.
How good is it?
Yeah, it was really
good. Ted Lasso, right? I would play for this guy, like, you would not, but he doesn't even know what football
Why
is.
Why would you play for him?
Because, do you know what it is about him, right? He's so, his empathy, is absolutely incredible, but he is just, he is what he is.
Yeah.
He's unashamedly him.
Yeah.
And he cares about everything, but he will still always just be himself, and he will always do it his way, even though people are visibly laughing at him and visibly taking the piss out of him. He doesn't care.
You spoke about that. It's being comfortable who you are.
He is the most comfortable man in his own skin ever, isn't he? He's incredible.
And this is it, right? People are perceptive, so we know if you're saying one thing, but there's something else going on.
Yeah, I don't mean it.
And it leaves us feeling really uncomfortable. Like, I don't know what's going on there. I can't put my finger on it.
It's a trust thing. It's a trust thing.
And the other part of that is, you know, the whole kind of blank face, if you give nothing, that is really unnerving to us because we like to know, how is somebody reacting to us?
Yeah.
So when people just say, like, don't give anything away, that actually is more anxiety provoking for people.
Yeah.
So it's not about that. But yeah, there's something just about being able to say, this person, again, knows who they are, right?
Yeah.
Which is the emotional fitness of a great leader. They know who
it's
they
good,
are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's such a good teach. Oh, you need to watch it.
I will. I've got a good, I think it's a good question. Right. So you hear the phrase big game players in sport and pressure, and what does a big game player mean to you, Ben?
Oh, yeah. Big game player is... So I always think the big games, when they come along, I honestly don't think you need to do anything different for a big game as opposed to what you might say is a small game. So whether we're playing Norwich tomorrow or we've got the game that's going to get us relegated if we don't win, I honestly don't think you approach it in any different way, because that's when... That's will provoke feelings that you're not used to dealing with. I think you're much better off doing it the same way, as long as you know you're doing it the right way and you're not cutting corners and all that kind of stuff. As long as you can do stuff in the right way, I think you always do it the same way. Like I say, games change on tiny little moments in games, but changing something beforehand, it's not what you're ingrained to do. So like, it's like, so I can change this to a different sport here, for example. So say cycling, okay? Say in the velodrome on the track, right? Say you've got Chris Hoy. He has worked his socks off down to the tiniest minute detail, right? Of this is how fast you're going to travel and this is how much power you're going to put out, okay? So say it's a three-lap race, right?
Yeah.
And the cyclist before him has beaten the time that Chris Hoy has got in his head that he's going to do, right? So this Chris Hoy has just worked for the last 3-4 years at working at this certain power because that's his maximum limit, yeah? And the guy before him's just beaten his time.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
What does he do at this point, yeah? The coach has just gone, he's just beaten his time. What are you going to do about it, Chris? He goes, I'll go faster. He can't just go faster. You have just worked for 4 years... at a certain power, knowing that is your limit, knowing you can't just go faster.
Yeah.
You have to do what you know you can do. So that's what I'm talking about. You just have to do the same things.
But what about, it's a really interesting analogy, but I guess the development of the question is there certain players, and it could be different sports, and let's not talk about big game, they only turn it on in big games, but when the pressure's on, they always seem to deliver. Like Steven Gerrard.
Yeah,
important goals, and he was brilliant every week when he played football. But the really big occasions, he just seemed to have
something
more. Extra. Now, what is that?
We
not what is it, because that's the keys to the kingdom, isn't it?
Gerard, but we often talk about players that lead and leading players, and I guess you will notice this. You'll have seen like players that actually sack off training, but they turn up on match day.
Yep.
It, regardless, they bring it on match day. And again, I think so. This is where it is really tricky because people are so unique and so individual. I really like your example with Chris Hoy, by the way.
I don't know what you'd have done, by the way. I honestly don't know the answer to that one.
It's a great question. But that we need, obviously, diversity in a team, of course, right? You have the official captain, and I know in a changing room you've got the unofficial people that also lead. So, again, I think it's about... I also agree with you about the consistency of your practice, right? That actually, if you try and change something when, you know, you've had no preparation, I was thinking of a marathon, you know, when people try and do something different in a marathon or, but that is often then what pivots people and actually it goes really badly wrong.
Yeah.
So being able to be consistent and adaptable, though, that is another key, right? You can be consistent with your practice, but if you can adapt and change to the changing environment, that's when you're more likely to be able to be successful. So again, what is it that helps you to do that? Well, again, in training, are there times when you are, you know, not having it so rigid and regimented? Are you allowing free play? Are you doing things that are completely separate to your sport? Obviously you are, but you know, are you finding different ways to be adaptable mentally too? Like, not just physically,
but
are you putting yourself out into situations that are uncomfortable?
You just said there about players that sack training off, but then can turn up. So
you'll
know in football, you have players who are, they would be labelled as a match player. They're a match player, though.
Is that what they call them?
Yeah, they're match players. That you know you can rely on them on a match. So reliability in football is probably the biggest word when you want to sign somebody. Can you rely on him? Yes, you can rely on him. He's a match player. He's a match player. Don't worry about his training. Don't worry about his training, but he's a match player. And 9 out of 10 managers will go, that'll do for me.
Have you got some examples?
Individual players?
Yeah.
Or
is that?
I'm not a million miles away from being a...
That's honest of you.
Yeah. Is that like famous one over the years? Is like Ledley King?
Yeah.
Partly because of the injuries.
Yeah,
that
was kind of forced on him, but you knew that put him on a match day and he was good to go. He can deal with it.
You talked about it in the past. Carlos Tevez was a match player, wasn't he?
There you go. Perfect one. Absolutely the same sort of thing. He did not like training. He didn't enjoy training. He must be on the same sort of level where... Like when I train, I don't have the adrenaline, but as soon as the match kicks off at 3 o'clock, this adrenaline boost comes over and I can jump higher and I can kick further and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. He is the biggest example of that I've ever seen in my life. He wouldn't really run in training. He wouldn't try a leg. If he was on your team in a six-a-side, you're losing because he would. But it took a few months, but the lads would see that every Saturday afternoon he would be there with bows and whistles on, and he was the main man, and he would run further than everybody, in more intense than anybody else.
Can I say on that point, I think there is something really important about like encouraging the players to listen to their own body. So when I've worked with players that are like that, that you're speaking about, you know, like match day, that's it.
Yeah.
Often they'll say like, I don't need to do this in training, or actually, I know I'm fatigued in this area and pushing myself here is actually going to make it worse for the match day, and I'm going to be a liability on match day. So I think there is something really about, again, that communication between the coach and as I'm sure it then built between the team, right? You're able to trust that he is going to show up.
Yeah.
He's not going to let us, even though he's not putting it all in.
That's so, honestly, that is so interesting. You've just said that, because knowing your own body in football it's almost like, we're taught to not know our own body now.
I agree.
Honestly, it's almost like technology is so advanced now, and there's something to read every part of your body, and they honestly
they're outsourcing it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like people won't ask you anymore. How do you feel?
Yeah.
Like I'm talking physically, they won't
tell you.
They will tell you because they've got a heart rate monitor on you. HRV. They've got your fatigue. Blah blah blah.
So interesting.
And they will honestly, they won't listen. Like a player might go, oh, my hamstring feels a little bit. I feel if I go out today, I might pull it. They'll be like, yeah, but you haven't run much. Like yesterday, you didn't do many miles, so you need to do it today to make sure you're. And they'll go out, and invariably, that's where you pick up the little injuries and niggles and stuff.
Right. 100%, I agree with that, and I see it all the time.
This is where this is again though. That this is has to be like this is where people skills come into play, and yeah. where a really good coach, a top coach, somebody that knows his players, assigned the players because he's done their due diligence on them. He trusts them.
Trust goes both ways.
Yeah, trust goes both ways. Yeah.
You've got to be able to ask your player, like, how are you feeling? And trust that actually I've had players that have walked off mid-training because that's the right thing for
them.
It's
not being arsy.
It's not them having a hissy fit. It's not them being arsy. It's actually they know their body. And I have to say, the really fine-tuned elite athletes do know their body. Yeah. I mean, it's like a finely tuned car, right? Yeah. It is. They know their body inside out. And we need to be listening to that. You don't dismiss that, because what are you encouraging when you do that? Them to override that, dial down that, and again, injuries. And if you look at them particular points in the season, you'll see injuries get really high, right? And it's not just about the number of matches, that obviously is important, the number of matches played, but it's, are we listening to our players? Are we listening to them in training? What's going on?
Yeah, it's good,
very
isn't it?
Good. We are nearly there. We're conscious. We've been talking for nearly an hour and a half, and we could talk for another
it's
5 hours.
No, I love it. It's been so good.
One point we didn't get onto, but we would love to kind of pick your brains on the social media aspect how players deal with that. So, Ben, do you want to start us off with how you've dealt with social media now and over the years?
So I'd say for me, I think quite luckily, when I was younger, sort of when I was at Manchester United, for example, when I was really sort of like well known and blah, 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 social media wasn't really a thing. Twitter, yeah. Instagram, it wasn't a big deal kind of thing. So it's not really, I wasn't really exposed to it so much.
Yeah.
But then as I've gotten older, one of my biggest bugbears is players searching their own names or getting in the comments and looking what people are saying to them. And I will say, I've done it myself for sure. I've done it myself. Now, as I'm older, I might look at it, but it won't enter. You know what I mean? I understand what it is.
Like an itch that needs to be scratched.
Like you're aware of it, but you kind of take it for what it is, because in my head, that person's view shouldn't really impact you or whatever. Anyway, and that's the way I try and explain it to young players anyway. But I can tell you for a fact that 100% of players playing will search their name, they will get in the comments, and I know it actually affects them. It gets in their head, and it is awful to see. It really, really is.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's so hard, isn't it? Like I, similarly, you know, if you think about your childhood, and I actually am so glad there was not social media
you're not
during
wrong.
The time growing
up.
So glad.
But it can, in my experience, it brings both positive and negative. So I think this is the other thing. Like on the positive side of things, I've heard people say they feel more connected to their fans, the fans that aren't trolling them, obviously. Yeah. They feel like they can represent, whether it's their country or their team, they feel connected to that. If it's family, I mean, you know, obviously not normally over social media, but it's a way of keeping in touch and connection. It also is a way of showing people who I really am behind this facade of a footballer.
The pin-up footballer,
Like it's actually your voice. And also, obviously, it leads on to post-career, like post-opportunities.
Yeah, sure,
right?
Yeah.
And then the negative sides, which are, it's so immediate. You post one wrong tweet or you have a bad day and it's out there for the world to see, millions of people. We are not designed to have millions of people looking at us and judging us. That is not how we were, our psychology, our social psychology is built. And it's so hard because if you think about it, many people don't know this, but the brain is still developing into the late 20s, early 30s. So your brain is not fully formed as a 24-year-old. Mm. Like we think of people as adults at that point, but they're not. So this really does change the brain, right? When you're seeing things that are incredibly negative, it is going to affect, you know, self-esteem. And I think it is that it's about being able to be intentional and put in appropriate boundaries around how much am I engaging with social media. Yeah. And look, let's face it, like technology hasn't come with a rule book, right? We've all just all of a sudden got these phones. We've got the internet at the tip of our fingers. Nobody's saying this is how much you should be using it or that. And it is addictive. We know that too, right? So there's so much that I think it's how you use it. It's how you engage in it. And I think it's that part, like, you know, through experience, right? You did it. Mm. You learned the hard way. And often we can try to think, and I've spoke to a lot of people who are later on in their career and they go in and they talk to the younger ones and And they go, but I know it's not going to make any difference. They're going to go and do it.
And they will. They do it. They will. 100% of players do it.
Yeah.
Literally 100%.
How can we help them? Like, knowing that, what can you put in place, in my mind? Like, because it's the future them that has the more experience. Current them doesn't. So what can we put in place to deal with? Okay, so I've seen X amount. Like, when I read this amount, what am I going to do? What do I, like, internally? We are going to have a reaction to that. You know, if somebody was attacking us, that brings up feelings in us, whether we know them or not. So what am I going to do with that? I think it's about the forethought that goes into it, because you can't say, just don't do it, right?
Like, they're going to do it.
The ratios, work. Your mind works in a strange, in weird ways, doesn't it? Because there might be 100 comments on a Fosscast video.
Yeah.
And you might read through and there's 99 really positive ones and one bad one.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because people around you, like you've had it over the years, where people around you will take the negative one and send it to you. And you then go, and I've never experienced anything like
just
this.
Just to underline it.
And I've never experienced anything like this. And recently, like, you know, the podcast comes up and, you know, our audience is amazing.
People were calling you Casper Schmeichel again, weren't they? It's well out of order.
Someone likes it, though.
I'll take that every day. But the one, there was one video I submitted, and like someone's like, oh, yeah, Tom's a twat, whatever, let's say. And then someone sends it me, goes, look at that. And I'm like, what do you want me to say to that? Thanks very much. That makes me feel good. Yeah, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I do. And I think it is hard, isn't it? Because the other thing it was making me think about is the people also that we didn't, when we went back to the great leaders, they give themselves credit. And yes, they want to improve. But they really can celebrate themselves well. So they don't just get stuck on that one, right? They are able to take that 99 and know what they're doing really well and enhance that and do that even better, right? That's just as important. So I think it's about how do you get out of it. It's not about that we can just avoid it. We can't just, you know, close our eyes off to these things because it happens. And again, being able to separate out and see, this is often about something that is being projected. Yeah. Like the intention behind somebody sending you that, like, what's that about, right? Like, this is something about them.
That's bang out of order.
Yeah, so, but being able to separate ourselves.
Yeah, that's probably more about them than it is you, to be honest with you.
Do you know what I mean? But it's like people tend to, but you look a bit back, going back years, I remember ringing you. We talked about it when, like, someone's going on Ben on, I think it was like on Talksport about 15 years ago, and I'm going, Ben, this person's saying that, and you must be thinking, why the fuck are you ringing me and telling me that?
I don't need to know this.
I don't need to know that.
I think it's important. So it depends what kind of arena you're in, right? So say if like you're a podcaster or you're a business, and it's probably important to read those sort of comments and gauge, like you say, what you're doing well and what you might need to change or alter. But I honestly think when it comes to sports people, I don't think you can take any one of them comments seriously. I honestly don't think you can, because whether it's brilliant, mediocre, or the worst, I think the only people, especially in sports, that you should be listening to is probably your coach, your parents, your family, your close loved ones. That's about the only.
These are people's perceptions of you. Right? They're not you. There's a gap, right? There's their perception, there's the gap, and then there's you. And so it's always through the filter of how they're seeing it. So yes, if you take that as gospel, it's about them, you know, rather than it being about, as we were just saying, like listening to my own body, or my wife knows me better than anybody else, or whatever it might be. So being able to kind of, again, be selective about who are you seeking this advice and guidance from.
But it's like you said about it in the past, you can't get too high when you win, and you can't get too low. It's about the importance of being consistent, isn't it? Yeah,
just stay there. Like, don't, like I say, it's brilliant when you win and celebrate it for sure, but then don't take it home. And like, I know for a fact it's probably not probably, but I know for a fact there's a lot of people out there, sports people, it could be just fans, for example. Like, they lose a game, they go home, they'll take it out on the family.
Yeah.
The family will suffer because of whatever's happened in the last couple of
hours. They're the nearest and dearest to you. They're like,
For sure.
Like, one thing I kind of say, and it doesn't, like, you argue with your wife, your children and stuff, and it doesn't make it right, but you kind of, you're closest to, you see the absolute best of you and the absolute worst of you, don't they?
Yeah.
And it's And he's trying not to.
But like, say, sports people in general, because it's their world. A lot of people, this is why I always think that it's so important to have other avenues of interest, other things that can take your mind off it, because you shouldn't be defined as a footballer. You shouldn't. You're a person. You're a human being.
Football is what you do.
Yeah. You're exactly. You're a son. You're a daughter. You're a husband, father, whatever it is. That's what you are. Yeah. And then your job is that. And that's great. And you have to be professional and it pays the bills and it will give you this amazing lifestyle, but you then can't take that home and impact the family because you've had a bad day at work or a bad result or something.
Yeah. On that, I've recently been working with somebody who was saying pretty much exactly the same, because when the morale and the mood is down with the team, right, if that is your only network, how do you cope with that? So this is why you need to have different support bubbles, different, you know, people that you go to, different interests, because when things are going badly in here, we need to be able to pull on something else. We need to be able to go to other people. Mm. We need somebody outside of the team where we can, you know, just cut back, let loose, whatever it might be. So it's really common, though, I think, when, and obviously it comes with its own difficulties, because when you're in the limelight, you are seen a certain way. So it can be really difficult to then find these things that a lot of people speak to me about. I don't even know what I like. Right, you know, I don't know who I am outside of football.
Really?
Because it's been their life since, you know, if you think about it, academy level, like this is...
That's quite sad, isn't it, really? Yeah. It is.
I think that's for part two on retirement.
Yeah.
Because the transition's there. There's a lot more we want to talk about. So I think maybe that's a good one for part two.
Thank you so much. Yeah. That was absolutely incredible. Yeah, it was. I told you it was going to be fascinating.
No, thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
But we really do appreciate that. Dr. Suzanne Brown, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
We always finish every episode, by the way, by doing Up the Fozcast.
Up the Fozcast.
Down the lens of that camera.
This one, Up the Fozcast.
Up the Fozcast.
Up the Fozcast.
Brilliant. Well done. Brilliant. Very good. Very good.
Yeah, really good.
Enjoyed that.
Really, really good.